This is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we have with us Olympic Peninsula author of 5 novels, Jonathan Evason. He is the best-selling author of the award-winning novels All About Lulu, West of Here, The Revised Fundamentals of Caregiving, soon to be a major motion picture starring Paul Rudd, and This Is Your Life, Harriet Chance. And in April 2018, Lawn Boy will be out. He lives, as I said, on the Olympic Peninsula with his wife and 2 children. He's written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, Salon, and National Public Radio. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Thank you, Sheila. Thanks for having me. And I'm up to 3 kids now.
Oh.
Yeah, I have a 5.5-month-old baby girl named Lulu now, too.
Named Lulu. Well, we'll have to see about that connection to your book. Well, congratulations. Are you getting some sleep?
This baby's been a dream. This baby has slept through the night from day one. She is the calmest, most imperturbable, least needy infant I've ever been around in my life. It's just a blessing.
Wow.
Get the child on the floor. We all eat breakfast. I get the other kids ready for school, and she just sits and looks at us with big, placid eyes. I can't believe it. I'm pinching myself. I thought this was going to be a hellish year.
Oh,
that first year can be tough, especially when you have 2 other little ones.
Yeah. I'm sure she wants to fit right in with the family, and she knows she's got to like look around and figure that out first, right? Maybe a good place to start would be with the fact that your first novel published was All About Lulu.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about it and why you then named your new baby Lulu.
My first novel, actually, you know, that 2008, All About Lulu, is actually, I think it was my 7th or 8th novel.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a bunch of unpublished books. I finally broke through with Lulu. I would liken it to kind of a first album. It has a whole lifetime of personal experiences in it. My dad was a professional bodybuilder. I always liked this idea of bodybuilding as sort of a, you know, metaphor for self-improvement. I grew up with these ominously macho men who couldn't walk by a reflective surface without flexing their muscle or pulling up their pant leg and flexing a calf. It always occurred to me that they were so focused on this self-improvement so that they'd spend 2 weeks in the gym just working on the striation of one little muscle group, and yet they never really turned that lens for self-improvement inward. So the book is in large part about obsessive love, but also masculinity in crisis.
And now you have a daughter named Lulu. So who is Lulu in your book?
Lulu in the book is Will's new stepsister, who he becomes obsessed with. The name Lulu for my child doesn't really have to do with the character, but it is sort of symbolic of the book that kind of helped us build our home and so forth.
I love that you said that the success of that book helped you build a home that will be her home. That's really lovely. I love the way you describe action in the gym all around perhaps one muscle group. And you have an eye for characters, that's for sure, and their gestures. And a sense of humor, which I first encountered by looking at your website, which is an unusual one for an author. I'll describe it the way I saw it, was a beer bottle for every one of your novels. There's the word tap room in there, I think. How did you decide on that kind of website?
Well, I like beer. Basically, that's kind of the fuel that keeps me going.
Okay.
For Lawn Boy, we're actually going to work with a regional craft brewery and make Lawn Boy Lager. The label will be like the cover of the book.
Oh.
It'll just be like a seasonal lager.
Does the Lawn Boy drink?
I like to do promotions with just beer. It's just something I built into my brand because I like it.
Uh-huh.
And it's kind of a fringe benefit. So like anytime I do any kind of book event anywhere, invariably the bookseller, the librarian, the event coordinator, there's always beer waiting for me.
And that makes me laugh. The beer's waiting for you before you read, during your reading, after your reading.
Before, during, after,
yeah.
Whenever.
All right.
Sometimes it's a gift. If I don't feel like drinking it, I bring it back to my hotel room.
Uh-huh. I like that. That's so sweet. That's nice.
Yeah. So, like, I go around the country traveling to all these cities, and I get to sample all these craft brews. My bookseller usually have something sort of regional.
Ah, so you have like
a... sort of indicative of the era, yeah.
A hobby interest that you can nurse while you're traveling around. It was interesting, very interesting to hear you say that you wrote 7 or 8 unpublished novels. Do you think now that you've got 5 out, any of those will then become published?
Well, no.
No?
3 of them are literally buried, like I dug a hole, salted the earth, so nothing would ever grow there again.
Mm-hmm.
They were not good. And that was more ceremony than they deserved. It just took a long time to get good. There's 2 or 3 that are really good, but as it is, I'm writing a book every year and a half, 2 years, so there's really no time to I'm always like 2-3 years ahead of my publisher, so I don't know where I'd ever have the time to squeeze these other ones in. Mm-hmm. But they're not that good.
How did you cope while you were writing novels that weren't that good? You were working on getting good, but how did you do that?
Honestly, kind of now in my life at 49, realizing why it is I have to write, I always sort of assumed that I just felt compelled to be heard, or I had stories to be told, or, but what I've come to realize is that I'm biochemically manic, like off the charts manic. I need to write because I need these big swaths of uninterrupted focus. Mm. And so it's the activity of writing. So I guess really the chief goal was never really publication in the first place. It was more like a sort of therapy, I guess. Yeah, just the activity of writing keeps me grounded and keeps me centered. Otherwise, I just spin out of control and drive everybody crazy. So it wasn't really hard in terms of just doing the work. And it wasn't like, well, 8 times the charm, I'm finally going to break through. I've just always been so grateful to have the work itself. I'm still finding new ways to fail at it. My last book, which would have been like, what, my 13th book I've written, was just an abject failure. The center wouldn't hold. It was a mess. Tried to rewrite the thing 3 different times over 10 years, and it just eventually got the better of me. I'm still failing.
I kind of like that. I like hearing that, because if we don't take risks as writers, then our work gets stale. So sometimes the risk is that the book isn't working, and sometimes it's that it worked. Thank you. Thank you for telling us that, because I think a lot of people don't know that about writers. Do you know the book? I think it's called The Midnight Disease, and it's about writers who can't stop writing.
No, I don't know about that. I can relate.
Yeah.
There's a guy who wrote 6,000 words in the last 40 hours.
Mm, wow. And you're working ahead of Lawn Boy now.
Yeah, I'm working on a novel called Legends of the North Cascades, which is sort of loosely a companion novel to my novel West of Here, which was set here on the peninsula. It was set in a fictional Port Angeles called Port Bonita, and it was about settling of Port Angeles and the erection and then the taking down of the Elwha Dam. It ended up being really timely. I'd been ruminating on the book for years and years and years while nothing was going on with the dam. And then just as the book came to publication, was like, you know, within about 4 weeks when they started taking the dam down. So it's just serendipity.
So I was going to ask you what inspires particular books and what inspired you to write that one.
With West of Here, you know, I spent my whole life camping pretty much every river valley on the peninsula, every spring and summer and fall, all the way around the leeward side and around the North Olympics and the West Peninsula, from anywhere from Queets all the way around to Staircase. And one thing that always captured my imagination was to get to the center of this beautiful, untouched wilderness, you have to drive through hundreds of square miles of just poorly managed resources and clear cut. And so Faulkner said that past is not the past. And he was talking about the institution of slavery in large part. But for me, the past is not the past here because of our own early follies, mainly like resource management and robber baron greed and stuff like that. And so I conceived this novel that sort of was a conversation between these two epochs, 1889 when Port Bonita was booming, and then 2006 when it's a moribund logging town. And it's just these two epochs in conversation. And it sounds like a big ambitious world beater in a way, but the idea was really kind of basically very simple, just dealing with its early mistakes 120 years later.
So are all of your books inspired by place, or maybe there are other kernels?
It's usually character. That of all my novels, that and Legends of the North Cascades, the one I'm writing now, are very much novels of place. But in them, the place functions itself as a character. So it's really always about character for me. Reinvention. I have to believe that we're able to reinvent ourselves how we want to. And so even though West of Here is told from something like 50 limited points of view, and it's got a bifurcated timeline, as I said, 125 years separating these two narrative lines, and then there's this big magical realist streak running through the middle. And I think there's 80 or 90 characters in the book, but really Port Bonita is the character. Everything else is ancillary. So there's really just, it's the place that ties it all together. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of a situation where it's place as character.
Thank you. And I know you've come prepared to read some passages from another of your novels, and maybe you could tell us why you chose that one and then read for us.
I'm going to read from This Is Your Life, Harriet Chance, for several reasons. One, it's the only one I can find in the house. but also it's my most recent novel. And it takes place mostly here on the peninsula. It's about an 80-year-old widow from Swim who goes on a Alaskan cruise, which her husband has won for her. The trip ends up being very revelatory for her. This is a novel that jumps around in time and space. It's a novel of reflection and recollection, so it's very nonlinear. I'm going to start with October 1st, 2013, Harriet at 76. You're still calling Deer Park the new cinemas, though they've been there for years. Look at that adorable couple down front, the ones who brought their own popcorn, the little hunchback with the crooked lipstick and the scarecrow and the yellow pants and the marine cap. Look at them, arm in arm, gimping down the aisle, quibbling over where to sit. Why, it's Mr. and Mrs. Bernard Chance, looking to all the world like a perfectly matched pair. Yes, 54 years of cohabitation has the two of you behaving like bookends, perfectly matched opposing supports, forced by proximity into cooperation. Really, that's no small accomplishment, Harriet, so go easy on yourself the rest of the way. The rest could have happened to anybody. The movie is forgettable, as in you couldn't remember it if you had to. Something Irish, or about Ireland, with a guy and a girl, but that's not the point. The point is that it's movie night, and the Chances are still making an effort late in life, though neither one of you likes to drive after dark, and my God, it's nearly $10 a ticket, even for seniors. Not to mention you haven't seen a good film in 2 years. Not that you can remember that one, either. You can't remember getting old. You can't remember when exactly you started carrying umbrellas, just in case. When you started scheduling your weekly hair washings, oversalting your food, or reusing Ziploc bags. It happened gradually. The years just wore you away, dulled your edges, leached the color from your face, and flattened you out like river rocks. Again, not the point. The point, not to belabor it, is you're old and sapless and enfeebled, especially Bernard, and yet you're still trying, both of you, still able. The world shakes its fist and rolls its eyes at you as you gum up traffic, slow down lines, and pay for every blasted thing and exact change. But by God, the Chances are not about to cloister themselves at home with their cream corn and network television. No, they're still out there wrestling with the world at large, still going toe-to-toe with progress, still absorbing change slowly. But when you turn to Bernard in the glow of the credits, expecting to share his vague disenchantment with the evening's lukewarm cinematic fare, he looks dazed and frightened, and something else, unreachable. Dear, you say, are you okay? Yes, fine, fine. But his tongue is heavy, and he sounds a million miles away, and he's slow to rise from his seat, and it's not a cautious slow. You reason that he must have nodded off during the film, heaven knows you almost did, and that the sleep state has left him disoriented. On the trip home, in spite of time-worn custom, you do the driving, and he doesn't make a fuss over the fact. In the passenger seat, he slumps in silence, and by no means a thoughtful silence. Something smells like urine. At some point during that forgettable movie, your husband has forgotten a great deal more. This is your life, Harriet Chance, falling off a cliff. Only later will you discover that Bernard has had an event, let's call it a stroke, and that it's likely not the first. Only later will you learn about the plaque on his brain. But let's face it, Harriet, you hardly have time to take it all in. It happens so fast. In 3 months' time, the police will find him wandering Klein Spit in his pajamas. In 6 months, he will not remember your name. In a year, he won't remember his own.
If you just joined us on KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend, you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life with Sheila Bender. Sheila is talking with Olympic Peninsula best-selling author Jonathan Evason about his writing career and five novels, which include The Revised Fundamentals of Caregiving and Lawn Boy.
I'll just read one more little passage. June 21st, 2014, Harriet at 77. Well, Harriet, it's come to this. You've lost control of your life. Or Bernard's life, anyway. Probably a blessing, don't you think? Really, it ought to come as a relief when you get right down to it. At least they're not trying to take your house. At least they're not coming for you. Bernard sits stiffly on the sofa, fully clothed, awaiting toast that is not forthcoming, while Good Morning America unfolds silently on the television, though neither of you is watching it. You never do. You just like the company. No matter how you entice Bernard to move from one activity to the next, one place to another, he's uncooperative. Like Bartleby, he preferred not to, though Bartleby was never this cantankerous. Still, you have no choice but try to move him. On at least five occasions already this morning, you've informed Bernard that you're taking him to the old mill for breakfast. Your favorite, you remember? Where's my toast, he wants to know. Yes, he loves toast, though he chokes on it frequently. It's early morning and the fog up the street is not yet lifted when Caroline and Skip arrive in Skip's SUV. Caroline opens the back door for you and Bernard. Who's she, Bernard wants to know. That's Caroline. Caroline who? Your daughter. Here you are, Harriet, in the back seat, clasping Bernard's hand in yours on the drive to Sherwood Arms. 3.5 miles, and it feels like you're driving to Spokane. You've dressed Bernard nicely, though dignity is lost on him. He'll foul the white dress shirt the minute anyone tries to feed him. He'll probably foul the diaper, too. But it's no longer on you, Harriet. Admit it. As terrible as it sounds, it's a relief. God, but it happened so fast. How is it even possible? Where the hell are we going, he wants to know. Look at Caroline, fondling her monkey fist in the passenger seat, 5 years sober. Look at Skip, 55 years old, gripping the wheel at 10 and 2, just like his father taught him. At reception, you try to distract Bernard, but he doesn't give a damn about any goddamn aquarium, does he? He wants his toast. Where the hell are we, he wants to know. You shepherd him past reception. The walk down the corridor is a long and toastless journey. Finally, you arrive at number 5. There's a clipboard affixed to the door, a placard with 2 macrame carrots that says, Home Sweet Home. It's so nice, you all say. Look at the view. They've thought of everything, haven't they? And the staff is just lovely. Oh, look at the television, Bernard. Just look at the size of it. But you're really just talking to yourselves, aren't you? Because for all Bernard knows, he's in Donald Duck's living room with 3 complete strangers. All he knows is he wants toast, bad enough to yell about it. But you can see it, Harriet. A look in his eyes, an alertness, as if somewhere behind the disease, behind the scar tissue, behind the fog of disassociation, Bernard is all there. He's just lost his ability to communicate, like somebody turned off his volume. You're certain he can see everything that is transpiring with crystal clarity, and he can't do a goddamn thing about it. Somebody, please, get the man some toast.
Jonathan, who is the voice who is telling Harriet about herself?
That's an alternate version of Harriet. A lot of people have wondered, is it some big game show host in the sky? Is it God? The way I conceive of the book, there's a couple passages late in the book when that voice starts to, when I kind of tip my hat and that voice starts to say, we, the collective. I viewed this voice as an alternate Harriet retelling her story.
I see. It's very compelling. It's a compelling voice to listen to and tells us a lot about Harriet. How did Harriet occur to you as a character?
I'm always trying to write about marginalized characters, almost always working class characters. I got to thinking about who's more marginalized in our culture than an 80-year-old woman. So, like, All About Lulu is, as a Billings Roman, it was a coming of age. And then the revised fundamentals of caregiving is sort of a coming of middle age. And so I guess I would characterize Harriet as a coming of old age.
I see.
It's just sort of rounded up the continuum.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a very endearing description of her, the first one you read, and of her husband, still tangling with the world. Living in Port Townsend, where we have so many retirees, some of the picture you drew was very poignant.
I live in Squim, so I know. And I'm guilty of marginalizing elderly women and myself. Like, I profile all the time. I'll be down at Safeway, and I'll see a line with, like, 7 people in it, and then I'll see a line with 1 little old lady in it, and I'll get in the line with 7 people every time.
Because
I know the routine. First, she hefts the giant oversized purse out, and out come the reading glasses, and then she fishes around for her club card, and then she pulls out the outdated circular.
Well, I hope that people listening can laugh, because luckily it's all of us sometimes and none of us all the time. You have a wonderful way of describing the details of people. And I know then, and we talked about where 2 books came from, and from what I read, a very beautiful interview with you about the revised caregiving book. And that came from a very sad part of your life. Can you talk about it a little?
It was kind of the amalgamation of two events in my life. One of them was the freak accidental death of my sister on her 16th birthday. The other was just about 20 years now, but my life just totally jumped the track in my early 30s. My first wife had an affair with my friend. My life just fell apart. At that point, I'm like a 32-year-old unpublished novelist, 7 books, marginally employable landscaper. I went through a period of just grief. It was like a blur for a year. So it was just sort of the next year was just sort of a journey back to life for me. And so I kind of fused those two personal tragedies into sort of one event. I wanted to write a book about surviving irredeemable loss, the necessity of surviving irredeemable loss, because sooner or later, it's going to hit all of us.
Right. There's nobody who's going to get out without loss. So I really value what you're telling us about writing, about how it comes from life experience, from a need to write, from your acute observations of people. And as hard as some of the things are that you are writing and that you've read to us, there's also a mirth in there. There's also something very much fun when Harriet's looking at the girl over there eating popcorn and not remembering the movies, and all of those things are things that we can all laugh about in ourselves, the things we notice. So I feel like through your eyes, I get to notice more about the people around me. So I want to thank you for that. Are you doing any mentoring of other writers?
Pretty much constantly, yeah. I kind of don't believe in teaching in the sense that I just feel like failure is the only way to really arrive at a unique voice or vision. But I give a lot of writers pep talks. I give them a lot of professional advice. And I feel like I'm more of a coach in my mentoring. I just keep them upbeat mm-hmm. so they can keep running at failure over and over and over again. I'm not really trying to teach anybody how to use the prismatic lens or, you know, how to play with limited points of view. Or I'm not trying to teach them structural or craft stuff so much as just an ethos and things like how to create a good workflow, how to maintain focus.
Mm-hmm. Which is something you live through because you maintain that through what you're calling 7 or 8 failures. I think that's incredibly
I'm not done failing, trust me.
Right, but you've learned something about how to look at that failure, how to know that it's not working and start something else or start again.
Yeah, that novel I was telling you about, The Dream Life of Huntington Sales, which has been like 500-pound gorilla for me over the past decade. Failing at that novel is probably the best thing that ever happened to me as a writer. I learned so much. I made some very fundamental discoveries about writing and what makes things work and like thematic cohesion. And I finally came to the realization that the reason the center didn't hold is because there was no center. There was no thesis. There was no one single idea that permeated every sentence of the book. So there was all these disparate themes and all these characters. And there wasn't that one thing. And I went back through and I looked at all of my books, and every one of my books has a single passage somewhere in the book that crystallizes the entire theme of the book, that acts as like a thesis. And every one of my books, I was able to identify that paragraph, but there was no such paragraph in Huntington Sales. So when I started this new novel, I wrote that paragraph first, thus probably saving myself 2 years of banging my head against the wall. I just learned so much from the act of failing, much more than I learned at succeeding.
Have you had readers of these failures who have helped you figure this out, or is this something you can come back to after a while and locate the problem?
Oh, many, many. You know, I've gone through it with my agent 3 different times, with my editor, with beta readers. Some people love the book. They love it for its craziness. They love that it doesn't hold together, but I'm not among those people. It doesn't work for me. The center doesn't hold, and there's really no way to fix it. And so what kept happening is, and why I finally just abandoned it for good, is that if I couldn't tell you exactly what the book was about, well, then that put the onus on my editors and my readers to try to figure that out and try to shepherd me towards what the book was about. And inadvertently, I guess, sort of co-opt my vision, and I just didn't want any part of it. I have to know what it's about.
I like that statement.
So, yeah, I mean, I tried to reinvent this thing as a noir, as a thrillers, plays with genre to a large degree. It was really, I mean, there's a real spark to it, and there's some wonderful material and some great characters, none of which I'll ever be able to recycle or reuse or anything, but still lives inside of me.
Uh-huh.
It just didn't work.
Well, thank you for sharing all this about failure, because I think that's a part of the writer's life that we don't always hear about. So you've already coached me to feeling more okay with, in my case, poems that won't arrive, or in the fullness that I would like to see them arrive. So thank you. And before we end, Jonathan, I want to direct people to your website where they can see the beer bottles. They can learn more about you and your books. So it is your name. I'll spell it. Jonathan Evison, Evison.com. Correct?
Oh, .net, I think.
.net. All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah, there's some coupon maven in the United Kingdom, some flamboyant coupon maven squatting on my web domain, so I have to take,
I'm
not about to pay him for it.
So we have JonathanEvison.net. And I want to thank you again so much for joining us on the program and for helping us see into your life as a writer.
Well, thanks for having me, Sheila.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.